Welcome to Software Architecture Radio, where we discuss the latest in software architecture patterns and practices with the hands-on practitioners creating them. You can find us on the web at softwarearchitecturerad.io. I'm your host, Matt Stein. So my guest today is my good friend Mark Richards. Mark is an independent hands-on software architect with 20 of his 30 years of experience in the industry playing some type of architecture role on what looks to be a myriad of different software projects. He's the author of several books, including Java Message Service 2nd Edition, and is featured in the book 97 Things Every Software Architect Should Know. In addition to that, he's a frequent speaker on the conference circuit, which is how we met, and gives various extremely popular software architecture trainings, well, pretty much around the world, it seems like. But today, I want to dig into a keynote that I saw him give at the O'Reilly Software Architecture Conference in London back in October of 2016. But before we get into that, Mark, why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and kind of how you got to be you at this point in your career.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. And thanks for having me at your podcast. So as Matt said, I've been in the industry for about 32 years now, a little over 20 of those as a software architect. And I have played a lot of roles during that time, obviously an application architect and also integration architect and enterprise architect. So it's given me kind of a well-rounded view of software architecture in general. But I started my career actually as an astronomer, believe it or not. And that was way back in 1982. But the hours were not great, and so decided to get into computers. And that's when I kind of started at CSE, Computer Science Corporation. And I worked there for a while, and then worked for IBM, and then became an independent consultant. And I started on the No Fluff, Just Stuff tour, the NFJS tour, back about 13 years ago, and that was a lot of fun. I think my passion is technology, but even more so, I think I have a passion for mentoring, training, and teaching, which is why I'm having so much fun doing a lot of training classes and conferences at this time. So, but yes, I have written quite a few books, including a lot of microservices books of late, and so having a lot of fun with that as well.
Yeah, it pretty much seems like if you're going to be doing anything in this space right now, you have to at least utter the word microservice a few times.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm riding that hype wave myself. In your keynote, which I really enjoyed, you really started out describing this kind of feedback, feed forward network. I really struggled to figure out a concise way to describe it, but when I was looking back at the slide, there was kind of this progression of hardware into software, into differences in human interaction, into social interaction, into just the environment itself. And mm-hmm. I think it really kind of lays this foundation of, hey, you know, what's really driving us to kind of fundamentally rethink software architecture at this point in time? And, you know, I'd love to ask you to kind of talk a little bit about how you came up with that progression. And, you know, unfortunately, without the help of the visual, but we can obviously point to that in the show notes so people at least have something to look at. But just kind of summarize that a little bit, kind of bootstrap our conversation.
Sure, Matt. The title of the keynote was actually The Evolution of Software Architecture. And as I started to research, quite a bit of research, actually, the question you asked about, you know, kind of that forward kind of thinking about what will architectures look like in 2017, what I started to realize was that regardless of the year, we've always been asking this question. In other words, in 1998, we were saying, what will software architecture look like in 2002? And it's kind of interesting because when we talk about the evolution of architecture or software architecture, or even the evolution of computing in general, there's really five kind of stages. And when I did all this research, I realized there's a vertical slice of evolution, but then also a horizontal slice. And each one kind of feeds the other. And let me give you an example. So the five levels vertically of the evolution of computing, which then influenced software architecture, were really starting out with hardware. For example, the ENIAC computer way back in 1940s, which then led, of course, to changes in software, which then, of course, led to changes in human interaction, then social interaction, and finally upwards to the environment, in other words, the Internet of Things. And it's kind of interesting. This is fairly straightforward. You know, hardware begets changes in software. Software begets changes in human interaction. The more sophisticated we get with human interaction, we change to social. And then, of course, like I said, the Internet of Things, where we're actually interfacing with things, equipment. However, what I observed when I was putting this together for the London keynote was that there's also a horizontal evolution as well. And that's what I found very fascinating. In other words, the changes in hardware going from, like, let's say, the ENIAC over to mainframes, going to distributed computing, then to the cloud, then to embedded systems within coffee pots and watches and things like this, didn't evolve on its own. And so, in other words, if we look at even the changes in human interactions, the way we actually interface with computers, the changes from all the green screens we had before kind of going to, for example, web-based technologies to smartphones and tablets all the way to watches, this as well was a horizontal evolution that cannot stand alone. So in other words, that kind of evolution requires changes and sophistication in software, architecture, and also hardware as well. So when we kind of look at that evolution, it really kind of does form a little bit of like a side of a pyramid where you do have kind of the hardware, software, human, social, environment going up, but then horizontally, these changes that are impacting those kind of horizontal movements across each of those areas. But the interesting thing is kind of looking at that kind of graph or chart, it's fairly easy to see collectively, kind of as a holistic view of how we ended up where we are today. I mean, it really is based on social need and the need to kind of interconnect different things together. For instance, on the Internet of Things, which is kind of where we're at today, you know, where are our architectures going to be able to support the next kind of evolutionary move? And that would be interacting really with our environment.
Yeah, that was the thing I found really interesting, which you just described, was that, you know, if you look at any one of those horizontal slices independently, you can see historically how things changed, but it doesn't really tell you why it changed that way. But when you actually bring those layers together and you kind of describe how, well, this put pressure on this, which caused this evolution, but then that evolution put pressure on yet another layer and caused yet another evolutionary stage. And it really kind of brought everything into context. I mean, it certainly helped me, so I'm sure it brought a lot of things into context for a lot of people, you know, maybe for the first time.
Well, let me give you a good concrete example of that, Matt. For example, if we take the magical buzzword microservices and kind of look at that evolution from kind of the monolithic type of layered architectures and some distributed architectures, but really kind of more monolithic over to microservices. I mean, this may have seemed like a fairly straightforward move, let's say maybe 12 years ago. Oh, we should modularize. But the problem is, we didn't really have the hardware and infrastructure capabilities to get to that level of modularization. And so, in other words, the advent of really cloud kind of architectures, and I'll describe cloud as really the self-service, on-demand, dynamic provisioning of hardware, software, storage devices, networks, all this, that's what allowed us to be much more agile in terms of the level of modularity we're seeing in something like microservices. So it's kind of interesting that that transition we may have seen back about 12, 15 years ago, but unfortunately didn't have the capability to do that. But the other interesting thing, Matt, if you kind of observe this little horizontal and vertical evolution, is also that of need. In other words, evolution for evolution's sake is not very interesting and sometimes doesn't lead towards the right type of architecture or solution. But where there's a need, that's really where I think those drivers for evolution really came into being.
Yeah, well, that's really how when I teach my own architecture courses, I really have a hard time starting with, okay, here's what the architecture paradigm is. I really always want to start, well, here's all of the stuff that gave us the why, that kind of drove us to the point of the architectural paradigm that we had in the past is no longer sufficient to meet the need. And so now that we have this new need, we're going to go and do this new style of development. And then, you know, kind of going back to your point about, well, we didn't always have the underlying resource that we need, whether it was something about the user interaction needed something for software or something in software needed something from hardware that we didn't have. You know, I kind of see a lot of that when, well, I guess the first time I really saw that was several years ago when we were doing No Fluff, Just Stuff, and Neil Ford was giving a keynote. I can't remember the title of it, but he kind of related this idea that, hey, if you want to know what's going to be hot in the software field next year, go back and read all the academic papers from 20 years ago. and you're going to find out, you know, it takes about that long for things to percolate into the industry, but it also often takes about that long for the hardware to catch up with the ideas that these academics were coming up with. You know, like I remember reading about the early days of things like Lisp programming. Lisp was this fun, you know, wonderfully elegant programming language that you could do all kinds of really cool things with, but the computers weren't powerful enough to run it because of all the underlying optimizations that you had to do to change a program from, you know, the way Lisp wanted you to think about programming to sort of the way the von Neumann architecture wanted to think about running programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time, their solutions, well, we're just going to build hardware that has Lisp basically baked into it. But I guess it's the only way we're ever going to be able to run this thing. But now in, 2017, you can run about, you know, 20 or 30 different flavors of Lisp on your laptop, and it performs quite well. So it's really interesting how that evolution takes place.
There is. And speaking of kind of those drivers, there's business drivers as well, not only those technical drivers, but the business drivers that push this evolution forward. Let me give you a really good example. Think of a typical legacy banking application back in the 90s. And let's use that as an example. And when you wanted to, let's say, check your balance at the bank, there's this legacy banking application that had access. You could, for example, call the bank and say, can you please give me my balance? You can go to an ATM machine and say, can you give me the balance? You could actually do it the old-fashioned way back in the 90s and actually walk up to a teller and say, can you tell me my balance? But there's something very interesting about this example, because those legacy banking systems worked very, very well back then. And the reason is because they had something I like to call controlled access. So in other words, no matter how many people were calling, no matter how many people were going to ATMs, no matter how many people were walking up to the teller and queuing behind all of these mechanisms, there were a fixed number of people, or I should say users, accessing that legacy system. And this worked perfectly fine. But what do we have today? Today, we've got online banking and also mobile banking. And so the point here is that we no longer have that controlled access. And this is what causes these legacy systems to kind of implode and not be able to handle the kind of volume that we're expecting them to handle today. And so this kind of transformation in technology really kind of led to that business need of evolution to be able to keep up with what I like to call that uncontrolled access. In other words, no longer in these legacy systems can we control and govern the amount of input into these systems, especially, like I said, through banking or online. And so this is really what one good example of kind of why this evolution was necessary in the way we interact and deal with technology and computers today.
Yeah, so it feels like, you know, as an architect, that you really have to think about the fact that the pressure that causes you to make a particular architectural decision might come from, well, really far away from the system itself and how we think about code and we think about servers and deployments, but it's the person sitting in their office 1,000 miles away banging on their smartphone screen that is causing you to make different architectural decisions than if they weren't doing that.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can imagine on a Friday afternoon when you're just continually pinging that legacy system through your smartphone to check your balance, to make sure your check went in, or in some of the cases where you're working for a startup and maybe you're the one that got paid that week. But right. In any case, we're talking about a lot of access to these systems, which originally, and here's the key point, these systems, these legacy systems we have in a lot of large companies were never, ever built or architected for this kind of demand. And so that is really the driver towards new architectures, new types of hardware, distributed computing to be able to handle this new kind of load.
Well, I want to switch gears a little bit and jump into these three different factors that you described as sort of influencing and driving architectural decision making. You talked about agility, velocity, and modularity. And I thought the velocity part especially was wonderful how you framed it. Let's talk a little bit about why is velocity important?
Sure. So I like to call these three aspects kind of factors or ingredients that go into what I like to call an evolutionary cauldron. And in fact, Matt, you're right. You listed them off, the agility, velocity, and modularity. And agility, I'm going to define as having the characteristics of speed and coordination. In other words, the ability to react quickly and appropriately to change. And here's the problem. A lot of companies, as a matter of fact, most companies are trying to embrace agility, not only from a technology aspect, but from a business aspect as well. And this is why a lot of businesses fail. And it's because agility, having the characteristics of speed and coordination, the ability to react quickly, means that we could be spinning in circles really, really fast and not going in the right direction. And that's where velocity comes in. And I'm going to define velocity as the speed of something in a given direction. In other words, it's not just agility that's going to cause these evolutionary kind of architectures, but agility combined with velocity. And so now we're moving very fast, appropriately, given that coordination of speed in a given direction. And so those two kind of are two of the key points. But there still is a missing ingredient, and that missing ingredient then is modularity. And I'm going to define modularity, of course, from Webster's definition is of having independent parts that can be connected or combined in different ways. And when we talk about modularity, again, there's a technical aspect of modularity, which I'd really love to talk about in this podcast, but there's also a business aspect of modularity. So if we look at this evolutionary cauldron kind of from an architecture sense, we can kind of see some of the concrete aspects of agility, velocity, and modularity. But it's not just architecture. It's also the way businesses have changed as well. And this goes back, as a matter of fact, Matt, I hope you didn't hear it. I was kind of chuckling when you were talking about the anecdote of just go back and look at research papers, because this whole idea of business modularity is not new. As a matter of fact, I've read some papers that go back to the 70s about kind of service organizations, especially within the financial markets or financial services sector. And those papers, a lot of them coming out of Harvard Business School, in fact, were written in the 70s, which were just finally starting to really realize the value of this and kind of how to do that. I don't think we had the infrastructure. We didn't certainly have the technology in place and also the knowledge of how to do this. And so it's interesting that these three ingredients we could talk about from an architectural standpoint and also from a business standpoint. But these are the three core ingredients for evolutionary architecture.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, if you think about what is the business modularity topic that comes up in basically every conference talk right now is Conway's Law, right?
Mm-hmm.
The way you've kind of divided your business into modules and the communication structures between those modules affect the architecture. And that was 1967 when Melvin Conway wrote, you know, that paper, which we pulled basically two sentences out of, and that's kind of the way so many of these, especially microservices talks start today is, oh, well, Conway's Law this, Conway's Law that, you know, just understand that and everything's going to be fine. So modularity, we at least, you know, kind of as we traditionally think about it, and, you know, I remember as far back as my very first programming courses in, probably even high school, maybe touched on it a little bit, but especially university. It's been a huge part of the conversation, and, you know, your software needs to be modular, and it needs to be loosely coupled, and all these things. At least in my experience, though we've been talking about that for many, many, many years, it has not fundamentally really changed the game of the software projects that I've worked on, or really improved the architectures that I've, you know, either inherited or, you know, been a part of a team that was making decisions. We were trying to get modularity, and we made modularization decisions, but seems like we very frequently made the wrong ones. So is it because we don't get modularity in terms of what it is, or why we need it, or, you know, is there something fundamentally new about how we're looking at modularity now that is causing us to make better decisions, or are we not even making better decisions? Are we creating another mess that consultants are going to get to clean up in 5 to 10 years? I don't know.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences as well with this drive in computer science, or in other words, as technologists, that we're driven really to create highly loosely coupled systems with a high degree of modularity. And of course, to you and I, this makes perfect sense. It's like, yeah, that's how we should be developing systems. But where I see this start to fall apart, or at least in some cases I've seen this not work well, is the lack of drivers. In other words, modularity comes with a price, and there needs to be some sort of driver associated with modularity. Generally, that links pretty directly with agility. In other words, when we talk about agility, and I'll throw out another definition, it's how fast can we react to change? And with a monolith, we can't react quickly to change. And so that's where the modularity kind of helps us, because we can now kind of carve out those pieces. So modularity is usually driven off of some level of agility. However, it comes with a price. The more modular our architectures are, the less reliable they become, because quite simply, they are distributed architectures. And the more distributed that architecture becomes, the less reliable it comes, the less available it becomes. When we talk about availability, especially if we put this into terms of like three nines or nines of architecture, in other words, 99.9%, which is kind of a baseline kind of availability. If every time you make a remote hop to another application, another modular service, for example, that's a multiplier from an availability standpoint. And so, you know, 10 remote hops on a three nines architecture actually becomes, I think it's 97, or a little over 97% availability. And so that also becomes an issue, as does simplicity as well. So all three of these factors, you know, performance also is impacted by modularity. So my point is, when we talk about modular architectures, they come with a price. But I want to get back to the driver piece. There's a wonderful article or a blog by Martin Fowler called Sacrificial Architecture. And it really resonated with me. And in this blog, Martin really talks about the fact of kind of throwing away portions of our architecture. And if you think about monolithic architectures that we currently have, this really isn't a feasible kind of idea. And what I drove out of that kind of blog, at least, you know, one of the things I saw from that is just this drive towards modularity, so that we can start thinking about sacrificial architecture, a portion of the architecture that no longer supports the business functionality. Do we have to scrap our entire application or our entire structural aspect in terms of the architecture? And generally the answer is no, if we have the right level of modularity. And so I think those are kind of the things that kind of come into play with this idea of modularity. But I want to talk about one other aspect of this as well. And that's kind of this this trend towards microservices, which, you know, again, is all the craze. And we got all excited about taking our applications and moving them to microservices, which I'll define as kind of single-purpose, fine-grained services that are standalone. These are applications themselves. And so it's not uncommon to have hundreds or even thousands of applications or services in your microservices ecosystem. But what we fail to see a lot of times is the driver for that level of modularity. I mean, we have, when we look at that superior testability, superior deployment, when we look at that kind of fine-grained level of modularity. But again, everything in our industry, everything we do has a price tag associated with it. And again, that's that performance, reliability, availability, simplicity aspect. So let me show you, take an example of, let's say, an admin portion of the application. So we get all excited about microservices and we take that admin portion of the application, which sets up groups or maybe reference data, stuff like this, and we make that into fine-grained services and microservices, let's say, all separate applications, and thereby increasing the level of complexity within our ecosystem quite significantly. And then you step back and say, for what reason? In other words, volatility is one of the key drivers of this level of modularity in terms of, like, let's say, microservices. But when we take a look at certain portions, reporting, admin, areas of the application that are not volatile, then it's silly to start splitting these up into fine-grained microservices just for the sake of microservices. And I think that's where I've seen the mistakes happen, Matt, is really with assuming every aspect of your functionality needs to be a microservice, and instead thinking about hybrids in terms of really coarse-grained services and like a service-based kind of approach, and where appropriate, move over to that level of fine-grained microservices or services in that case.
Yeah, that's helpful. So, I mean, the question that comes up over and over and over again when I'm working with clients is, what microservices should I have? You know, where should I decide to draw the boundaries? How many of these things should I have? What things should I look at? And it sounds like, actually, and I may have missed it, I didn't hear you say it, but thinking about it the way we described it in physics, we kind of thought of velocity as vectors. So we had the arrow, and the direction of the arrow was obviously the direction of the velocity. And then the length of the arrow that we drew would indicate the magnitude of that. And, you know, as I kind of started thinking about, you know, what microservices should an architecture have, I kind of started thinking about it, well, in terms of a couple of different ways. We've discussed, you know, bounded context from domain-driven design. I've been reading a book recently called The DevOps Handbook that talks a lot about the notion of independent value streams within a business. But I think another way that you could probably think about this usefully would be, you know, well, how many different velocities do you need to have in your business and then consequently in your architecture? I've got this one business concern that needs to go at this speed and go this direction, but then I've got this other business concern that needs to go this other direction at maybe a different speed, and maybe I have a third, and maybe I have a fourth, and those are obviously going to change at different rates, but they're also going to be delivered and deployed and have different feedback loops associated with them. So, you know, if you could think about, well, hey, here are the things that we're working on from a business perspective right now, and here are the different velocity vectors that we need to have, that's probably going to drive, well, maybe each of those different velocity vectors needs to be a different deployable microservice that has its own life cycle, so that you don't end up kind of tangling those vectors together. Does that make sense?
What a perfect concrete example of how agility and velocity play together. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, to kind of meld in the modularity piece, you know, kind of that third ingredient really fits in here well, because of the fact of really with that agility piece of being able to achieve that multiple level or those multiple levels of velocity. So yes, perfect example. And as a matter of fact, I kind of want to supplement that by really talking about these three ingredients, agility, velocity, and modularity, because really, when we talk about agility alone, as we've kind of talked about in this podcast, that's not enough. We could be spinning around in circles going nowhere. But really, what all these really provide us is, all three of these ingredients, is a high level of deployment, testability, and scalability. And as a matter of fact, if we kind of go back to the example I talked about a couple minutes ago with the banking application, that legacy banking application, the whole idea of agility, deployment, testability, and scalability really leads us towards that definition of competitive advantage. I mean, when we talk about competitive advantage in business, these are those ingredients to that. But it becomes more than just being able to push out products fast, because that competitive advantage also requires that very quick feedback loop. Pushing changes out, getting feedback from customers to be able to then react quickly. Here's that agility thing again. React quickly to that feedback loop to be able to push more changes out faster to customers and react to that feedback. And if you can picture this little loop kind of just going faster and faster and faster, that's what we're really talking about with that competitive advantage. And that scalability piece is that, like I said, that kind of that fourth ingredient, which you can kind of visualize thinking about that legacy banking application.
So one of the last things that I wanted to touch on is one of the last things that you touched on in the keynote, which was, you know, you were answering, you know, the big question that obviously was on everybody's mind after the first probably 15 minutes of your discussion, which was, okay, what's next? What's coming in software architecture? And you had three factors in the cauldron. You had really three primary things that were going to be characteristics of the future of software architecture. And as I remember you summarizing those, there was this concept of a much tighter integration between data and functionality. And, mm-hmm. and in that, you talked a little bit about streaming architectures. There was this notion of self-healing systems, and you kind of brought in the reactive aspects a bit to that. And then finally was this idea of architectures that are going to constantly evolve. That's just a feature of the architecture, is that the architecture is always changing. And so we're going to be driven as architects to, you know, make that easy to change. Let's maybe talk about that a little bit in maybe a less scripted way than you mm-hmm. had time to discuss on stage.
Sure, exactly. Because this was really that kind of, you're right, that future of software architecture piece. And it's interesting that originally when I was putting this keynote together, I actually took a, kind of a serious look at where, based on my 30 years of experience, where I saw software architecture going, also, you know, supplementing with that, with the research I've done on the evolution of computing in general, whether it be architecture, hardware, software. And you're right, those three key aspects kind of came out as really call to actions. In other words, what I turned it around, I really turned it around to kind of say, where are our problems? Where are our inhibitors right now to evolution? And that's where that first one came out. Realizing that one of the problems we have yet to solve in software architecture in general is this integration of data and functionality. In other words, kind of that mindset that we're in where we have data and we have to go grab it and it's separate. In other words, there's this brick wall that separates us between the data aspect and the functionality aspect. And I see this as a barrier to evolution. And streaming kind of architectures are one step in the direction to better integrate this functionality and data together. But I think we need to overcome this mindset. This is going to be, in my opinion, a paradigm shift, really, of not considering data kind of a separate entity in and of itself. But the reactive piece is where I really get excited, Matt. This is right now one of my key passions. And really within, when we talk about reactive, you may go, oh yeah, ho-hum, yeah, I've read the manifesto and stuff, but it's much more than that. Under the context of self-healing systems, what we have the capability of really doing now is leveraging patterns. I'm reminded of Morpheus. And what if I told you that you can create systems that can grow as your business grows without any changes or human intervention? There's patterns within reactive that allow you to do that. What if I told you that you can create systems right now with the current technology we have that can handle any sort of amount of spikes in user load or transaction volume, anywhere from, let's say, from 2,000 to 200,000 spike of transactions? We have those patterns available. Patterns that allow us to self-heal those systems, almost like biological systems. This is why I'm excited about reactive architecture. It's really put kind of a nice packaging around these patterns, which aren't necessarily new. As a matter of fact, the thread delegate pattern I've been using for, I would say, about the past 10 to 12 years, workflow event pattern the same. And these are patterns of reactive architecture. This is one necessary element in order to achieve an evolutionary state. But really, the final crux there, Matt, is really this call to action, I would say, I guess, about the fool's errand of continually looking into the crystal ball and saying, what should our architectures look like? You know, maybe about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, there was some possibility of doing some fairly accurate predictive analysis, but not anymore. Things are changing so rapidly in technology and business that it's really just not possible to do that predictive analysis anymore. And that's why I call it a fool's errand. It's really a call to action to really focus internally on our own applications, leveraging reactive, leveraging streaming kind of architectures to better integrate data so that what we have, as you had indicated, Matt, was this ability to continually evolve our architectures over time. That's where we should be placing our effort, moving towards a level of modularity with those appropriate drivers, you know, focusing on velocity combined with agility. Putting our mindset in this mode is what's going to give us that evolutionary aspect for architecture in the future.
Well, we're winding down. There's one more feature that I like to include in pretty much every episode, and that is, you know, what is kind of the one biggest piece of advice that you would have for a software architect today to either do better work or improve their career? Or if you had one thing that you could share with the aspiring software architect, what would that piece of advice be?
Well, in my experience and opinion, I would say, hands down, the number one piece of advice I can give is to focus on people skills. You know, there's a lot about software architecture we talk about in terms of the technology and the techniques and stuff like this, but 50% of software architecture are those people skills, the facilitation, negotiation, the mentoring capabilities, leading teams, making teams effective, presentation skills, effectively conveying your shared understanding of the architecture. This is the area that I think I would offer the hands down best advice. And the problem is this is probably the hardest piece. You can't Google a lot of this stuff. And so I think that, that's what I would put down without even thinking as the number one piece of advice, just to focus on those people skills.
Cool. And you said you can't Google that, but as I recall, it seems like you have some training offerings of your own around that specific topic. Is that correct?
Indeed. Yes. I've been, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this podcast, one of my true passions in life is training and teaching. And I do have the ability to do that now through NFJS, No Fluff, Just Stuff, through training, software architecture training courses that we're offering. There's a 3-day software architecture training where I cover all sorts of patterns, the process of architecture, as well as kind of the soft skills, that facilitation, negotiation, leadership stuff. And then we're now offering a new 2-day enterprise architecture training where we kind of focus on more the higher level enterprise architecture. We look at some of the frameworks, Zachman, TOGAF, TAFFM, Dragon One, some of these things, a lot of the modeling techniques of business, how to facilitate change, how to transform the enterprise, both from a functional systems aspect and a data aspect as well. So, and both of these are hands-on courses with quite a few architecture katas, in other words, exercises. So yeah, those are definitely, Matt, two resources. As a matter of fact, I've also written a lot of O'Reilly reports and videos, of which if you go to my website at wmrichards.com, and go to the publications section, there's links to all of those, and a majority of those are actually free. But if you have a Safari online account through O'Reilly, actually, You can watch them all for free. And so there's a lot of resources that both myself and my friend Neil Ford have been trying to put out there, given this problem of quote, you can't Google this stuff. And so it's a way of a catalyst, really, of being able to accelerate that learning curve from developer to architect.
Very, very cool. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast, Mark.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And I will have to say that another fantastic resource is Matt's podcast as well. So please keep listening.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Architecture Radio. For more information, including other episodes, visit us at softwarearchitecturerad.io. Join the discussion by posting to an individual episode's comment thread or leave us feedback on iTunes. You can also message or mention us on Twitter at @SWArchRadio. Until next time, this is Matt Stein for Software Architecture Radio.